This is an ABC podcast.
Ali Kasalelia, Fagalawalayatu, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. On the show today, Fiji's Supreme Court is hearing a landmark case on whether the country's 2013 constitution can be changed. And shortly we'll cross to PNG to hear about a government official found guilty of misappropriation and abuse of office, and how extreme heat is shrinking our tropical bird populations. All that and more, but before we start, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, paying respects to elders past and present. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol, Tagia Tumas. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, the Supreme Court in Papua New Guinea has found former Deputy Finance Secretary Jacob Yafai guilty of misappropriation and abuse of office. He authorised more than 40 million kina in unlawful payments to the disgraced lawyer Paul Baraka, who is already serving a 20-year jail term. The court ruled Yafai failed his duty to verify claims, saying his negligence cost the state. Now, for more, I am joined now by PNG journalist Scott Wairei. With that, I say good morning, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks, Scott, for joining us. Could you just give us a bit of a background of this case? Like, how did Jacob Yafai become entangled in the Paul Baraka payment scandal?
Yeah, so Jacob Yafai is what's called a Section 32 officer. His task, one of his primary tasks, is to authorize payments under the Finance Management Act of Papua New Guinea. So the court found that he abused his office and authorized several payments, a series of payments totaling up to 41.8 million kina to Paul Baraka's law firm. So that happened over a period of years starting from 2012 to 2013. And it's taken a long time with a lot of exposure and a lot of controversy around those payments, a lot of discussion in public, questions from the public, questions from politicians as well. So it's come to this where the court has actually found him guilty. The sentencing hasn't been handed down yet, but the guilty verdict has been passed.
Yeah, Scott, as you said, the court, said Mr. Yafai authorised more than 41 million kina in payments without proper checks. What exactly then did he fail to do, and why was that so significant?
Yeah, so the courts found that he didn't go to the Solicitor General or the Department of Justice to verify the claims to actually make sure that Paul Baraka had actually done the work for them, because Paul Baraka was engaged as a representative of the government within the Justice Department to hear cases, attend to cases for government departments. So he was paid with that assumption. So Jacob Yafai's role was that he was the one directed to make those payments over a period of time.
But Mr. Yafai has actually argued he was acting under political directives, right, from senior leaders. Are you aware who were these leaders, and how did the court respond to that defence?
Yeah, so firstly, the request for payments came from Paul Baraka. He wrote to Jacob Yafai in the Finance Department, asking for those payments to be made. And that letter was also copied the Prime Minister at the time, Peter O'Neill, and the Finance Minister at the time, James Marape. Now, James Marape, who's the current Prime Minister, signed off on that, on the letter saying, verify, peruse, verify, and settle. So he's gone to court as well as a witness, saying that, the word settle doesn't actually mean that Jacob Yafai had to settle. It simply meant that it had to be resolved. So, it's a battle of words. It was a battle of words in court as well, trying to define what those words actually meant, the handwritten note by the former finance minister.
So then, Scott, what does this case tell us then, you know, about the challenges of political influence, I mean, and even financial oversight, you know, within PNG's public service?
Yeah, it's a big problem. I mean, if you look at how many people, how many public servants have actually gotten into trouble from footnotes, just simple footnotes on a recommendation to pay. A lot of them have been charged. A lot of them have gone to court. Even, you know, one politician, former politician, has gone to jail over a simple footnote several years ago. So it's public officials come under immense political pressure if they're politically appointed or if they're looking to take on the top job and want to gain political favors. You know, they come under a lot of pressure. In this case, you know, a lot of people are saying Jacob Yafai appeared to be under immense political pressure as well. So, yeah, that's the discussion that's happening.
Okay. Well, we know that sentencing is set to happen in September. So looking ahead, what impact could this ruling have on, again, future corruption cases or even on the accountability of senior public servants there in PNG?
Yeah, the first one, the Paul Peraka sentencing, was huge. I mean, 20 years for a lawyer that previously acted for the government. I mean, he had one of the biggest law firms in the country. So that was significant. Now, with this guilty verdict, it's also huge for the public service and just sets a precedence around corrupt activities within the public service. The other side of the argument is that, you know, people who were in the background, you know, the politicians who were in the background, haven't been punished yet or haven't gone to court yet in the manner in which Yafai and Peraka have gone to court. So it's something that will be discussed, in the weeks and months coming, in the coming weeks and months.
Well, again, that sentencing in September, we will definitely be keeping in touch with you, Scott, as to what the outcome is. But again, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning.
Always a pleasure.
And that was PNG journalist Scott Wade speaking there.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, Pacific governments say their need for help to finance and build major infrastructure projects remains huge, despite increased activity in recent years. But they have to be delivered on their terms. Several heads of state and senior ministers have outlined their infrastructure needs to development partners, financial institutions and businesses at the Pacific Infrastructure Conference in Brisbane. Liam Fox was there and filed this report.
There's never been a greater focus on promoting development throughout the region by building stuff. And Pacific nations have China to thank for that. The spread of Chinese companies building Chinese government-funded roads, runways, wharfs and the like over the last decade forced Australia and others to up their infrastructure game to counter what they saw as China's growing influence. But Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister Johnny Koanapo told the Pacific Infrastructure Conference his country's infrastructure needs should not be exploited by the region's big powers.
Too often, Pacific Island countries have found themselves having to navigate the delicate space between genuine development support and external geopolitical interests. We must be clear that our vulnerabilities must not be used as leverage to advance foreign strategic agendas.
Assistance must be transparent and aligned with national development plans, he said. In a country beset by frequent natural disasters, Mr. Koanapo said infrastructure projects have often been reactive, rebuilding after a cyclone, for example. But planning is becoming more proactive. His government is exploring what he called a build, operate and transfer model with the private sector, particularly in the aviation sector.
The build, operate, transfer framework offers an opportunity for mutually beneficial collaboration where the private sector can finance, design, construct and operate key aviation infrastructure for a defined period before transferring full ownership back to the government.
Papua New Guinea's Deputy Prime Minister John Rosso said the upcoming 50th anniversary of his country's independence has thrown the daunting task of improving critical infrastructure into sharp relief.
My country will be turning 50 years old next month, to be exact, on the 16th of September, and I, along with my colleagues and in government, including our Prime Minister and the broader PNG political leadership, are talking about what changes we need to make to change the development trajectory of the country for the next 50 years.
Local involvement in foreign-funded infrastructure projects is critical to build local capacity, he said, but it's proving hard to achieve.
Imagine this, when you're building a road or an infrastructure in Papua New Guinea, most of the tender procurement process that are put on by international agencies ask for a PNG company for local content to apply for, and they ask that you should have a surety or guarantee of $50 million. No average company in Papua New Guinea would be able to do that.
Mr. Rosso said things are changing though. Development partners are listening more. And there are success stories, like the $260 million redevelopment of the Angao Hospital in his hometown Lae.
The way the project was run by the Australian government is the way we want it to run. It should be done properly with 95% local content and subcontractors in that particular project.
The Asian Development Bank is the second biggest provider of finance for infrastructure projects in the region, behind China. And it has sent a large delegation to the conference, including two vice presidents. One of them, Bruce Gosper, said the ADB is increasing its activity further in response to demand from Pacific governments.
So our current active portfolio is about $3.9 billion, so that's doubled from a decade ago. And we're envisaging a pipeline of more than $3 billion over the next 3 years.
The quality of ADB finance projects have been criticised in the past after contracts were awarded to the lowest bidders. Mr. Gosper said the bank's approach is changing.
We're emphasising quality. So in the bid evaluation process, we're ramping up how quality is the most important thing for these projects. Price still has an important role, but quality to ensure that they're fit for purpose, they're climate resilient and they're delivering long-term benefits.
Another reason for the big delegation in Brisbane, Mr. Gosper said, is to put out a call to Australian businesses to help the ADB meet the growing demand for infrastructure projects in the region.
We've got a lot of work coming on, so we need business to be actively engaged. We need engineers, we need developers, we need contractors, we need construction firms to actually look at what they do in the region.
And that is Asian Development Bank Vice President Bruce Gosper, ending that report from Liam Fox. This week, Fiji's Supreme Court is hearing a landmark case on whether the country's 2013 constitution can be changed. The push to reform the charter has been simmering since it was put in place more than a decade ago by former leader Frank Bainimarama after he threw out Fiji's original constitution. Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka has promised amendments to restore what he says is a more democratic and inclusive system. Whenau Whanua spoke to John Frankel, a professor of comparative politics at the University of Victoria in New Zealand, about the debate around the constitution.
The current constitution, the 2013 constitution, was imposed on the people of Fiji. It was not put to a referendum. It was not drawn up by elected authorities. It was not put to a constituent assembly. It was simply passed by decree. The Bainimarama government even threw out the report of the very constitution review commission that they appointed and drew up their own constitution. So it's a deeply undemocratic document. But that's a There's a problem here because the judges that are that have convened on the Supreme Court in order to deliberate on that constitution, they were all appointed under the 2013 constitution. So the first question they ask is whether they have jurisdiction and what powers they have to deal with the inequities in the 2013 Constitution. And from some of the remarks from the bench, you can see their problem. They have they know they need to do something. They know that this is an undemocratic document, but they find it difficult to act. They've been asked whether the previous constitution, the 97 constitution, is still valid. There are all sorts of complications with that. It would involve restoring bodies under the 97 constitution that don't exist anymore. A lot of the politicians elected under that constitution are dead. They've been asked also to write down the amendment provisions of the 2013 constitution. At present, you can only amend that constitution if you have a double 75% majority, 75% in parliament followed by 75% in a nationwide referendum. That's an impossible kind of threshold. Some people are saying that that's possible. It's ridiculous. It was drawn up to that high level in order to make it totally unchangeable. So I think you can see from the comments coming from the judges that they know that they have to do something. They can't just say, oh, sorry, we have no jurisdiction here, but it's difficult for them to act in accordance with the law.
You mentioned inequities. Could you expand on that? What are the inequities?
Well, I mean inequities in the sense that it is perhaps a different word might have been better. Unfairness of the Constitution. It's unfair in that it was imposed on the people. It doesn't have deep inequities in the sense that it treats all Fiji citizens as equal before the law, as do most constitutions. It has all sorts of, I suppose one could call the enormous powers that it grants to the Prime Minister and the Attorney General inequities. And the fact that it deprives certain other organisations of powers, those could be described as inequities. There's certainly been a lot of complaints that it deprives indigenous institutions of rights.
And what is it that Rambuka people want to be changed in this constitution? What is it about this constitution that people want to be changed?
Well, a lot of people focus on the electoral system, although I've argued and I would argue again that the electoral system can be changed within the 2013 constitution and that it can be changed for the better within the 2013 constitution. The openness proportional representation system that Fiji uses is not bad in itself. It's its use of a single nationwide constituency that causes all sorts of problems. I won't go into all the detail. I've written this up in the Fiji Times in the past. I think the other important things to change would include the lack of checks and balances in the 2013 constitution. The fact that there are untrammeled powers put in certain constitutional offices and there aren't enough counteracting powers that would enable less centralized forms of power.
And it's going to be quite a task, I mean, to basically almost rewrite a constitution.
There are various different ways that this can be done. Sometimes, often it's through a constitutional review commission. Sometimes there's a constituent assembly. Usually there's some public consultation. And usually the politicians have the final say. And therefore, usually there's some agreement across the floor. In Fiji's context, constitutions, or certainly the 97 constitution, was a compact between the political leaders of the different communities. And that's, I think, important moving forward. And there are some people who are very against the referendum. I heard one of the lawyers arguing in the court this morning that referendums are a bad idea because they are very costly and very divisive. And when pressed on this, he said that the reason why referendums are very divisive is exactly the same as the reasons why elections are very divisive. It may be the case that referendums can be handled badly, but if they can be handled well, they can cement and bed down a constitution.
And that was John Frankel, Professor in Comparative Politics in the School of History at Victoria University in Wellington. Pacific Beat. At Samoa, where campaigning is well underway for the major political parties vying for seats at the upcoming snap election at the end of this month. 190 candidates are running for parliament, 22 of those are women and 2 whawhawhinges. And whawhawhinges play an integral part in Samoan culture. It's a recognised gender in traditional Samoan society. And one of those candidates is independent candidate and whawhawhinge Whalesaupule, Se Maleola Vaialia Iasua, who is running for the Ngangai for Maunga 2 seat of Savai. Now, Whalesaupule joins us now to discuss the significance and challenges she's facing as she steps into the world of politics. With that, I say, Afio Mailo, Afionga Whalesaupule, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the invitation, and yeah, so looking forward for the interview and the discussion this morning.
Well, yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Before we really get into the conversation, I suppose firstly, Whalesaupule, for our listeners, you know, who aren't aware, can you maybe define the term whawhawhinge, please?
Thank you for your question, and whawhawhinge terminology is the Samoan term that is used to define who we are, and it's more of, you know, a cultural identity for whawhawhinge who refer themselves as Samoan.
Mm. Thank you for that. Okay, well, when we look into the world of politics, what is your view right now with the state of politics in Samoa?
Well, as you are aware, with the current situation now in Samoa, to do with, you know, our political situation, and, you know, I can't say, like, you know, much on that because it's on the news, and you can see a lot of writings about it, a lot of debate going on heading to the general election. But yeah, I'm so grateful, and I'm so looking forward to the process next week. So it's an exciting experience to learn, but also at the same time, a very exciting journey. Like, you know, I would say this is more of, an important but also best election coming up. So I'm so looking forward to the results.
Well, this is the thing. I know it's not your first time entering the world of politics. You actually finished third place at the 2022, you know, by-election for the district seat. What have you learnt from then that you think will help with your campaign this round, especially as an independent candidate?
The last trial was the by-election, and it was a last-minute preparation to enter for the election in 2022. We had our general election 2021 and then our by election 2022. So, yeah, that was the last minute call. And so after that, so the preparation was started, you know, for this general election. And yeah, I'm so looking forward to it. And it's not an easy work to do, but service is one key thing for me to have a look at, but also some of the caps, you know, for the first run that I had to fulfill. And so those caps were all addressed, and yeah, I'm so looking forward to the results coming up next week.
Mm. And as you said, it's not easy work, but you know, as the terminology that you use as a whawhawhinge, what has that been as a journey, you know, looking towards the fact that I even mentioned in the intro, 190 candidates, only 22 of them are women, and then there's only 2 whawhawhinge that have decided to join. Like, what's that journey been like for you?
Because I would say I am a proud, you know, member of the whawhawhinge community in Samoa. And joining the election is not very much a concern for me to contest for the election, you know, for you being a whawhawhinge and labeled as a whawhawhinge. So because, first of all, there's no law can stop you from, like, any individuals here in Samoa to contest for the election. But as long as you meet the requirements and all the requirements does not state anything for, like, you know, to stop you, like, whether you're Fafa Fime or whatever, to join the election. So from doing so, I would say, you know, what's important, but also more important for me, is the service, and that's the Tautua in Samoa, is the most critical part, and it's the most important element for, you know, for us to deliver, you know, for our people. And that only counts, you know, this time, because people will see and people will look at you, what have you done, and what are you doing, what did you do for the people. So it's all going back to your service and what you offered, but also what you can offer if you become as a representative of your constituents.
And what's been the response from the public with you having to join the world of politics?
I don't receive any negativity, but also about myself, but also, you know, for me running as a candidate for the upcoming election. And that was also the feedback in my first trial. So I would say, like, you know, exceptions, but also, you know, your service as a Fafa Fine is matter, but also counts. If people understand you and your service that matters for them, I would say, you know, people will not, like, you know, throw you any discriminatory statements or anything. So, you know, it's how you carry yourself. And I would say everyone is equal, but also everyone is important in Samoa. But, you know, again, it's going back to what you offer, but also your service to your people.
Yeah.
And that only matters.
Of course. Well, can I ask, you know, what are some of your priorities that you want to see addressed as you run, you know, with your campaign?
First of all, is very much the social sector, because I've been spending a lot of time working for the Ministry of Women, you know, during my time with the government for over 20 years. So I would say my priority would definitely be health, education, gender equality, social concerns. So so that would be my priority. But on the other hand, you know, it does not take away the fact that, you know, economic empowerment in terms of creating opportunities, income-generating activities for young people, but also, you know, business opportunities. For our people at the rural areas, because I am from Savai, 1 hour drive to Salilonga. I mean, catching a boat, you know, coming to appear is a long way. So I would say, you know, it's social concerns, but also economic empowerment. Infrastructure, we have, problems with our infrastructure, so for the roads. But yeah, so that would be my third priority, is the infrastructure.
And Felisopoli, if elected, what would this mean for you and your community?
Oh, I would say, yeah, it's a milestone. It's a breakthrough for all of us. We have come a long way, and I know it's not easy for us to get in. You know, for the election, but also if we and if I win, you know, it's a breakthrough, and it's an open, it's an open opportunity for all of us to see this through, and that's why I keep on knocking, and I also keep on, like, you know, pushing for this pathway so that, you know, to achieve, and this is the full achievement of human rights.
And again, just look, as we wrap up, though, what then would be your encouragement for those from your community, even from the Fafa Fine community, wanting to get into politics?
I received statements from our local communities, but also our international affiliations, like our, you know, Samoans living abroad, but also, you know, our staff are our president, but also, you know, our team here. So, you know, statements, but also messages encouraging us like, you know, running for this is, you know, is grateful for me, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I just want to say, Fafitai Tilelava, for your time this morning, Falesaupule, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. And just say Fafitai for the opportunity to join the program, and I hope to continue this, in the future. And thank you for also acknowledging, you know, the support from our end. Fafitai Tilelava.
Yeah, Malo Lava, that is independent candidate for Ngangai for Maunga 2, Savai in Samoa, Falesaupule, say Maleula Vaialia Yosua.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
It could be a year before we see the Marshall Islands men's soccer team in action again after their history-making debut weekend of matches against US Virgin Islands and Turks and Caicos. There is no shortage of enthusiasm for their next encounter, but there is a shortage of funds. And up to now, requests by the Marshall Islands Soccer Federation for membership of the Oceania and Asian Confederations have fallen on deaf ears. However, the man who masterminded the project to put Marshall Islands on the world soccer map, head coach Lloyd Hours, says now they have demonstrated they can hold their own in an international fixture with the minimum of preparation, and so the hope is the decision makers will sit up and take notice.
We performed well, I think better than a lot of people expected, and it gives a bit of a fire in the belly that you want to make sure it's everything aligns again, and we just continue to make sure everything across the project, from kids, female, disabled participants, you know, whatever it is, it all goes as well as it possibly can from now onwards as well.
The performance of the team, I'm thinking they must have surprised you. Even in your heart of hearts, you could not have expected a group of players who'd never played together before, who'd been together for 6 days, to perform as well as they did.
Honestly, unbelievable. And I think half the squad as well has not even played a real match, and some of them played futsal, but yeah, 11v11 is the first match for a lot of them, and to go and play like that against FIFA nations. I think even the USVI game, we hit the post at 2-0 to make it 2-1, and 2 centimetres to the right, that changes the game 1 minute into the second half, and I think that really is just an eye-opener in terms of our own performance. But then we took it into the Turks and Caicos game, and the pressure was off slightly, and it almost gave a different pressure, because internally we had our own standards and we believed that we could get something from that game. And yeah, we went in at half time 3-1 down. We're just so frustrated because we were the better team. We conceded 3 poor goals from the same way, but once we changed that, we were definitely dominating, and we felt frustrated that we didn't get something from it, which is unbelievable, because you go into that game, everyone's expecting the worst, and we definitely didn't do that.
Blanton laying it off along the left. Back it goes. Josiah Blanton could be in. A moment of Marshallese magic. At long last, a goal for the Marshall Islands.
When that first goal went in against Turks and Caicos, clearly it's an historic moment. The feeling within the camp at that point must have been enormous.
Oh, yeah, and I think you can see that as well, the way that everyone reacted. Everyone just absolutely bombing down the touchline to just jump on everyone. It was just surreal. But then I think almost the second goal was just as important, because that same feeling was there. Like, everyone's sort of still celebrating, everyone, the staff on the side are hugging, and it's just an unbelievable moment in that sense as well, because once we scored that second goal, we're looking at it thinking, right, this is still something special. We scored 2 in a game. We didn't expect to score 1, but now we're going to push on with the last 15 minutes. We can get something from this. It was, yeah, such a surreal game, such a surreal feeling all over.
I'm guessing for the players, and indeed for you and the rest of your coaching team, it's kind of disappointing that you had to stop. I mean, you'd like to go on and play another game now and keep that momentum going as soon as possible.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%. We'd go into another game now just believing we could really go and win that. I think genuinely as well, if we played another 10 minutes against Turks and Caicos, we'd have won that game. I think, in my opinion, there was a real strong penalty shout last minute of the game. And I genuinely believe that if it was, 5-10 minutes longer, we'd score and we'd keep going. So the fact that we probably won't play again now for another year, that's the upsetting part of it.
It could be as long as that. These players have to wait for their next chance.
It has to be. Yeah, we just don't have the money to do anything sooner, unfortunately. It's still nothing from confederations, which is really frustrating. But yeah, still no regular funding our end. So unfortunately, it does have to be that long wait, because we have to begin the fundraising process all over again.
So what is it going to take for a confederation, be it Oceania or Asia, to admit Marshall Islands and let you build on what you've started?
Honestly, I couldn't give you a definitive answer, only because I think we've felt strong in our applications to them in terms of meeting criteria, aligning our strategic plan and everything towards what was required to be affiliate, or in a lot of cases of our application, full members. And we haven't really heard anything back from any angle, from any confederation, which is a little bit frustrating. We can understand it in a sense of 11v11 appearance or performance in general, but now we've got that, we've shown that we can do it, we can't be ignored any longer. There's got to be a discussion at some point, and hopefully that's sooner rather than later.
There's talk of a Micronesian confederation being put together with some of the other countries that are on the outside or only halfway in at OFC. So we're talking like Kiribati, Tuvalu, and Nauru, of course, there's a project going on there. Is that something that Marshall Islands wants to be involved with, or do you prefer to push on and try and get full membership in OFC or the AFC?
Yeah, we've been part of these discussions for a while as well, and we were instrumental in certain aspects of it. Same again, we'll keep it open. We have good relationships with those nations. There's definitely no closed door, but we do believe that we still want to be part of a confederation because we have big aims, big ambitions. And for us to do that, it means being part of the stronger organisation.
And would the objective for the next international match at Marshall Islands plays to be in Marshall Islands?
We can make it happen. The stadium is lovely. But I think the opportunity to play in the States showed that we can get good opposition to go and play there. It has a good community feel as a home ground as well. And whilst we aren't confederation members, maybe we are better doing that because obviously half the squad being from that way, it makes financing and funding the trip a little bit easier anyway. At this stage, I couldn't give you a definitive answer, only because we would love to play in Majuro. We can make it happen, but then does that limit the opposition that we play? We don't necessarily want to go and play against some of the regional nations in the area that aren't confederation members themselves. We want to be at a higher level. We want to make sure that we can play against opposition that we want to be playing against long term. And at the moment, if we've got opportunities to play in the States against the nations that can get there easily, then that's probably an option we're going to explore. But saying that, we've had a couple of OFC members reach out to say that they'd be interested in playing in 2026. I won't name names just yet. But yeah, I won't rule it off the cards just yet in terms of where we play.
Last point, what does what has happened over the last few days say about you and what you've been able to achieve?
I think sometimes we look at it and it is all about a project, and we make sure that we do this for the benefit of everyone else around it. But yeah, if I take a step back and look at it, it's definitely a proud moment for myself. I feel very proud of what we've done, and hopefully that's the start of something bigger and longer term as well.
And that's Lloyd Hours, head coach of the Marshall Islands National Men's Soccer Team, reflecting on a momentous few days for everyone involved. And Lloyd was talking to Richard Hewitt.
Join me, Natasha Madden, for Sisters Let's Talk. I'll be interviewing incredible guests and discussing issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
She was just going on to 19 when she had a baby. I instantly blamed myself.
I had to take pictures of some pollution and all that, and I was attacked on board out at sea.
Tune in to Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Are you seeing or hearing less colourful birds than usual? If so, it might not be a coincidence. Turns out extreme heat from human-driven climate change is having a dire effect on tropical birds. In fact, new research has revealed it's reduced bird populations in tropical regions by about 30% since 1950. So to find out why this is happening, we're joined by Professor James Watson from the Centre for Biodiversity and Conservation at the University of Queensland. With that, I say welcome, James, to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, appreciate your time. How did you actually carry out this research?
We used two different data sets that were allowed us to actually explore the impacts of climate change on birds. There's a great data set out of the Living Planet Index, which is run by WWF International, which basically stores all these population data around the world. And so we're able to look at 3,000 different populations of birds across 90,000 different observations over the last 70 years. And we're able to compare that with climate changes, extreme event changes, and also land use changes. And so we're just asking the question, why are we seeing drops in these populations, and what best explains it?
Well, yeah, and you just explaining that, like 3,000 types of, you know, birds with 90 observations. I mean, with that, what is the extreme heat doing then to these birds to make their population shrink at such a drastic rate?
Yeah, look, so we had a really good look at all the data and showed that tropical birds really were getting hammered by extreme events, extreme heat. That's what really emerged from this study. As you said, about 30% of the populations that we saw across the tropics had declined over the last 60 to 70 years. And this was explained by extreme temperature, extreme heat. And the biological reason for this is that birds, especially in tropical regions, haven't evolved to live in a very extreme temperatures. They have specialized niches. That means specialized habitats that they live in. And they don't like going beyond the extreme temperatures that they can live in because they just can't cope. The biological response for birds is they don't have any sweat glands, so they're unable to sweat. So they go into hypothermia often when you go beyond their biological capacity to deal with extreme heat. And when they go into hypothermia, they'd often just die. If they're able to survive the extreme heat events, you know, the 2 to 3 days of really, really hot temperatures, what science shows is they often have serious liver damage and they're unable to breed as effectively. So over time, when we're experiencing more and more really hot days, what you're seeing is less and less birds because they're just able to cope.
That's very unfortunate. So then what types of birds are mostly affected?
So it's tropical birds, birds living in rainforests and savannas, you know, those woodlands and grasslands that you see across the tropical areas of the world. What we saw was, bowerbirds, birds of paradise, those beautiful parrots, toucans, those kind of species are the ones that are in these data sets that are disappearing. In Australia, I have a separate set of studies which look at tropical grass wrens, which is a really cool bird that lives in the spinifex and the tropical woodlands of northern Australia. And we've been trying to understand why these species are declining. And again, what we're seeing is that these birds are just getting too hot in the middle of summer in extreme heat events, that they are doing weird and wonderful things like going to water in the middle of the day, which they normally would never do and stuff like that. So you're seeing these behavioural changes happening already.
Well, James, were there any countries where bird populations were sort of dropping, you know, particularly fast, or is it just happening equally across all these tropical countries?
Yeah, ours was a global study, so we could only use the data that was collected in these populations that the Living Planet Index were able to collate. So, but what we were able to see is in Central America and South America, that had a really profound effect. Northern Australia had a profound effect. You were seeing these things dropping out there. I mean, and what was interesting is that other researchers, independent of us, in places like Panama, had been documenting losses of bird populations in these really intact, isolated rainforests. And I couldn't understand why. There was no other threatening process there, and that they had noticed over the last 10 or 20 years there were just far less birds in these rainforests.
Wow.
And this is kind of like the smoking gun, is that maybe this is the reason why, even in places where there's no logging or low mining, we're going in there and doing surveys and finding less and less. So sadly, it's impacting basically across the world, and it's, you know, biologically, because a lot of these tropical species have never evolved, they haven't been able to cope with these extreme heat.
I understand even your study found that the impact of climate change on birds is perhaps even greater now than the impact on direct human activities. I'm talking about logging, mining or farming. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. But it's not saying that those things aren't a problem. They are still a major problem. And, you know, what our study points to is the fact that we've got to let birds adapt to a rapidly changing climate. So we're not showing that all birds died. We're just showing that certain parts of the population disappeared. So what it also points to is some birds are able to survive these extreme events because there's still those birds available in those ecosystems. So what it means is that we've got to keep those ecosystems intact. We can't keep on degrading them with bulldozers and logging and mining, because what that means is that these populations get much smaller, and therefore when an extreme heat event occurs, they're unable to evolve and adapt to this problem that they're facing. So while we're finding that extreme heat and climate change associated with climate change is now the biggest problem, the solution is basically, beyond halting emissions, is to try and keep these habitats as intact as possible, to stop the bulldozers, to stop the logging companies and the mining companies, because that gives these birds and other animals the best chance to survive.
Yeah. Well, James, how much hotter then are tropical climates now than they were, say, 30 years ago?
Well, so on average, we know that it's been a 1.5 to 2 degree warming across the world, effectively. What we find in, you know, that's an average global temperature increase, right? So we know that's happening. But what we're seeing is these extreme events. Sometimes it's up to 5 to 10 degrees hotter when you get a extreme heat wave. So I know, when I was a kid in Northern Australia, it would be very rare that the temperature would get beyond 40 degrees, you know, when you're wandering around in the field doing bird watching and doing, you know, your studies in science. Now it can get up to 48, 50 degrees just in an extreme heat event day. So we're seeing these rare, I mean, the isolated events, like one to two year heat events being much, much, much more hotter than they were even 30 years ago. And that's what's really affecting the birds, because they're just not used to it. And it's not just birds. I mean, this will be happening across mammals as well. We know that trees are really, in the tropics, are not really well suited to actually a rapid drying and heating event. So even though we have no data on that, our suspicions are it's not just the birds which are facing this challenge. It's actually all the species in the ecosystem.
Mm. And I'm wondering, does the data say, you know, this trend will continue, or is there a way to stop it?
So the trend is getting worse and worse is what data is, because it's over 70 years, so we're able to look at different time periods, and it's getting worse, that's for sure. And the models, the different models for climate forecasts are that there's going to be more warming in the across the world, and also more extreme events, more extreme heat events. So we know this will get worse. So it really points to the fact that we have to halt emissions as quickly as possible, because the ecosystems that live in the planet that we're creating are just not able to cope with this kind of heating. So that's, you know, this is a real wake-up call that we're already seeing a major problem. But as I said before, it also just points to the fact that we've got to give nature a chance. We've got to give these birds and the trees and the wildlife that live in these tropical ecosystems a chance to actually survive in the future, so our kids and our grandkids can actually, you know, enjoy their beauty and actually see them flourishing in nature. Because, you know, and the only way to do that is to ensure that not only do we reduce emissions, but we try and stop the degradation of these ecosystems. So try and limit roads and mines and logging, so it gives nature a chance.
Mm. I've learnt a lot just in this small conversation that we've had, James. Really, really fascinating. Look, that's all the time that we have for this morning, but really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. That is Professor James Watson from the Centre for Biodiversity and Conservation at the University of Queensland. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, where the Supreme Court in Papua New Guinea has found former Deputy Finance Secretary Jacob Yafai guilty of misappropriation and abuse of office.
The court found that he abused his office and authorized several payments, a series of payments totaling up to 41.8 million kina to Paul Paraka's law firm.
And that was PNG journalist Scott Wade. Remember, you can find our top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, and you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And as always, coming up after that, it is Nija Daily. So until next time, adoa afato. You've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Wade, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.